is not getting to the ground. You see this every day. Right now, it's nighttime. It's colder outside than it was in the daytime. Winter is sort of starting to come, and we all know it will get cold in the winter. Climate models know how to simulate day and night, and they know how to simulate summer and winter. This is not a difficult calculation. If the sun goes away, it gets cold. So a war between India and Pakistan, we don't know how many weapons they have for sure, and we don't know how big their weapons are. They could be very small, like the Hiroshima weapon, or they could be big, like the ones that North Korea has tested and that we commonly have in our arsenals. So that produces some uncertainty. For the smallest yield weapons, we think about 1 billion people globally would die in a war between India and Pakistan. In India and Pakistan, we think the deaths there would only be on the order of somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million. So the deaths from the bombs blowing up is not very high. The deaths globally from starvation is a significant fraction of the world population, which is currently about 8 billion people. So in Canada, 95% of the people would starve to death. In the United States, 25 to 50% of the population would starve to death. In Russia, about 75% to 95% would starve to death by the second year, which is not even the worst. The climate continues to get worse to about 3 or 4 years, and it takes almost 10 years to recover. And we made some very optimistic assumptions here. We assume that the amount of food that's left that can be grown locally, there's no transport assumed here, no food is shipped in. But currently, the world survives on food transport. And you may remember that maybe it was 10 years ago here, we had a big snowstorm just before Christmas. The grocery stores had nothing to eat in them within a day or so. And we started to run out of gasoline because people couldn't get into town with those materials. So the cities, on the average, have about 7 days of food and storage in them. If you don't keep bringing food into Boulder in 7 days, everybody gets hungry. Probably everybody has heard the story, which is in the Bible and in the Quran, about the Pharaoh and the cows. How many of you heard the story of the Pharaoh and the cows? So there's a guy in prison in Egypt, and he was telling everybody what their dreams meant. And the Pharaoh was dreaming about cows. And he didn't know why was he dreaming about cows. So he went to, I think, David, and I get my characters mixed up in this. The Pharaoh said, well, what does this cow dream mean? David said, it means there's going to be 7 good years, and you should store up food for 7 years. And there's going to be 7 bad years, and then you can feed the Egyptian population. And this was a big success, and the Pharaoh, who had evidently a 14-year term, was very happy. This is not true of the modern world. In the modern world, there's 60 days of grain in storage. 60 days. If you don't keep growing grain continuously, starvation happens. For example, Russia often has wheat failures. In the Carter administration, we sent them in Russia, Soviet Union, a significant fraction of all of our wheat, because otherwise they're going to starve to death. In the Middle East, you may recall in the last few years there were food riots going on, which led to this overthrow of a bunch of governments there, including in Syria. That was all driven by crop losses going on in Russia and other places, and they stopped transferring as much food there. And those people spent a lot of their salary on food. So 60 days of food is what we have. And that's why this is really dangerous, not just for nuclear wars, but also for some other global events that could stop trade of food. Okay, what happens if there's a war between the United States and Russia? If there were a war between the United States and Russia, 95% of the population is predicted to die. In Canada, the United States, Russia, China, the Middle East, and Europe, 95% of the population would starve to death. And I started to mention that we had an assumption in here, not just about trading food. We also assumed that the food that you need to stay alive, so the 5% are surviving, they get all the food. and then 95% of the people get nothing. That's not going to happen. The 95% of the people are going to kill the 5% of the people, and then they'll all starve to death. Okay, so what do we know here, besides the fact you're probably depressed now? So we have this problem bounded. On the small end of smoke going into the stratosphere, there's about 1% of a million tons of smoke from these big forest fires going into the stratosphere. This warmed the stratosphere up. We could see it in satellites for about a year afterwards. It didn't do anything to the ground because there wasn't that much of it. We have the problem bounded on the other end from the dinosaurs. There was about 50,000 million tons of smoke in the stratosphere there. The sun was obliterated. There was not enough sunlight for photosynthesis, below 1% for a couple of years there. So that's another endpoint we have. The Pakistan-India case is probably a little over 100 times worse than these single fires in British Columbia and Australia. We think that would kill crops at mid-latitudes, like a farmer looking out at a field of corn that could never develop. So anyway, the sky would look black and the sun would barely be showing through it. A nuclear winter from a war between the United States and Russia and China would probably get you within about 1% of what happened to the dinosaurs. And it would probably look like snow-covered middle latitudes. You know, there would be nothing that you could grow there. There'd be snow on the ground from the low temperatures and ice everywhere. Nothing would grow. Okay, so where does this leave us? Right now, we can't stop an asteroid impact. But people are working on it, and a small one we probably could stop in a decade or so if we really tried it. I always find this amusing. So in the movies, what does a movie show? Does it show astronauts going to the asteroid and scientists figuring out what to do and engineers figuring out to help? No, it shows oil workers. Some of the people who make movies think the hard thing is to drill a hole in the asteroid and put a bomb in it. And of course, there's a girl oil driller and some boys, and they spend all their time fighting each other over the girl, and they barely blow it up and save the Earth. This is not possible. We couldn't blow up a significant-sized asteroid, even with all the nuclear weapons on the planet. It also remains to be seen if we could prevent a nuclear conflict in global starvation. So history shows that the world scientific community can help eliminate nuclear weapons. I read the quotes to you from Gorbachev and Reagan. They both quoted their science establishments saying that they had to do something about all these nuclear weapons or they'd want to kill everybody on the planet. Okay, so you've probably all heard politicians say a nuclear war cannot be won and should never be fought. So all the politicians are trained to say that. They all say that. But do they understand it? Do they actually mean that? Or is that just lip service? So the goal of the group that I work with is to make sure the politicians know what I just showed you, to make sure that they're not paying lip service just to this. And as I mentioned already, this is not a hopeless situation because I think there are good reasons to think that Donald Trump, in his quest to get a Nobel Peace Prize, might want to do something about this as soon as he solves the Ukraine war by negotiating a new treaty with Russia. Okay, thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about either one of these topics.
Will the bacteria survive?
Sure. There are lots of things that would survive a nuclear conflict. Cockroaches is the most common example people give. They're very resistant to radiation. And so there'll probably be a lot of creatures that reproduce very rapidly and have huge numbers of individuals out there that can regenerate the population. And there are places that are probably not as bad as others. New Zealand, Australia, and Argentina, for example. And the reason for that, let's take New Zealand as an example. So New Zealand grows a lot of sheep, which it exports. And the sheep eat grass, which is pretty resilient. So in a situation like this, New Zealand would just keep the sheep and they'd all eat sheep. Might get boring after a while. We had lamb for dinner, so I like that. But they could eat their sheep. But if you look into it more carefully, you discover that that doesn't actually work because the people in New Zealand don't have the ability to make oil. So all their tractors and cars and stuff would pretty soon run out of gas. And they don't have the machinery to repair their generators. So it would fail there. Australia has got a similar situation, except they grow a lot of wheat. So they probably could feed their population. Probably the best thing to do is to go to Argentina. If they didn't kill you when you tried to get into Argentina, there might be enough stuff to eat there. Iceland looks like a good place to go in calculations because they fish a lot. But that's probably a mistake because there's a big ice sheet that builds up around Iceland, and they wouldn't be able to get their ships out to actually go catch any fish, which happened to them in the Little Ice Age in the 1400s. So there are places, there are refugia that you have a better chance of living in.
Putin has talked about tactical nuclear weapons. Did you and your co-authors look at what use of those might do?
Sure. So what is a tactical nuclear weapon? There's two definitions of a tactical weapon. It's not a strategic weapon. The strategic ones are long-range missiles going across the globe. The tactical weapons can be carried on airplanes, on short-range missiles, on cruise missiles. They can have any size you want. The other definition of them is you don't know anything about them because they're not covered by treaty. Russia has about 2,000 tactical weapons. Many of them are mines and things like that on ships, but a lot of them are designed to be carried on airplanes like they're using against Ukraine. There are dual-use aircraft there, and on cruise missiles and on short-range missiles. So they would attack Europe with tactical weapons. Tactical weapons have the same yields as strategic weapons. And we have no idea. The United States now has about 5 tactical nuclear weapons. They're on a submarine. In the first Trump administration, they put 5 tactical weapons on a submarine. Why? No one knows why he did this. Some people think he wants to use a nuclear weapon so he can break the taboo against the use of nuclear weapons. Other people think he just thought they'd be handy if you had to dig something out from the ground like they just did in Iran, trying to get rid of their nuclear weapons facilities there. So tactical nuclear weapons could mean we don't have many. Pakistan has quite a few, about 50, and the Russians probably have 2,000, and they probably could use 600 or 700 on Europe, and probably would do that in a conflict because France and Britain have nuclear weapons. Russia, as Obama said, is a tiny country, and it doesn't make anything anybody wants. Russia's a failing state. It's like North Korea is a failed state. There's one family there with money. Everybody else is starving. Russia is oligarchs. Like North Korea, they're putting all their money into military instead of putting it into boosting their economy and building things people want. So it's a failed state. It's moving toward failure. Most of their money comes from oil, which we don't want anymore because of the carbon dioxide problem. So that's very dangerous situation there in the future with Russia. And they might want to set off a tactical weapon to scare us more. Right now, Russia has two interesting things. It has a cruise missile that's nuclear-powered that can fly around in the air forever. So they envision launching a bunch of these things and having them fly around in the air forever. They actually had one blow up a couple years ago and kill a bunch of people. The other thing they have is they call it a torpedo. It's a drone submarine. We also have some. Their drone submarine is meant to have a gigantic bomb on it. They're going to put them in American harbors, and if they ever feel like it, they'll blow up a whole city with it. They just threatened to put one downwind of the UK about a year ago and told Britain that if they didn't stop helping Ukraine, they'd blow it up downwind of Britain and contaminate the country with nuclear radiation. So that's another kind of single weapon explosion. That's a really large megaton weapon that they supposedly have there. They can be any size. The United States has, as I mentioned, 5 of them on some submarines. And those are low-yield weapons. I forgot what they are. I think they're like 5.
Low-yield meaning?
5 kilotons or something. So they're about
comparable to Hiroshima?
About a third of the Hiroshima bomb.
Okay.
Okay. A low-yield weapon like Hiroshima destroyed a whole city. Yeah. You know, so a low-yield atomic weapon isn't that safe. There's no point in using one in the Ukraine, for example, because unless you want to destroy one of the Ukrainian cities, they're of no military value. You've got a dispersed army there. The destructive range on one of these weapons, tiny little ones, is probably a quarter of a mile or half a mile or something. And so you're not going to really destroy an army that way. So it really wouldn't do any good to blow anything up unless you want to destroy a city, which, you know, they could do. Or they could destroy power plants, which is, I won't get into whether these are against the rules of war, but there are a bunch of things in Ukraine that are against the law of war already.
Brian, how certain is your explanation of the death of the dinosaurs? And if that were incorrect, would it change your assessment of nuclear winter?
The smoke I mentioned and showed, described a picture of it, is in the same layer with the iridium. You know, so the iridium, the micrometeorites, probably fell out within a year. At least that's what our models suggest. We know how big they are. You know, they're sand-sized grains. You don't pick up sand, you throw it in the air, it falls right out. That's how fast they're falling. So they're not going to stay up very long. So that little layer of smoke from forest fires, you know, it's only millimeters thick, has not only got the smoke in it, it's also got the iridium in it. And, you know, so the iridium and the smoke had to have been generated in less than a year. Some people said, oh, well, the fires, they occurred centuries later as forest burned. That just isn't possible because of where these things are co-located. So I think we're pretty sure that that smoke, which is still there from 66 million years ago, and it still looks the same as forest fire smoke, if you put that back in the atmosphere, that is, like I said, night and winter. I mean, it's not even winter. It's like totally black, like a moonless night. We know pretty well what's going to happen if you do that. It's just going to get colder and colder and colder. And the only thing that keeps it from getting really cold is the oceans. So the oceans have a lot of energy in them. And so the oceans slow down the cooling. So even these small wars are capable of driving things at really low temperatures, but the oceans stop them from doing it very rapidly. So I think we have a lot of confidence in what happened to the dinosaurs. It's much less easy to say what happened in a nuclear conflict because it hasn't actually happened. You know, we don't know what would happen. I mean, I always get the question, which I got at lunch today, how about just one nuclear weapon? Well, we blew up 550 of them before 1963, and they didn't do anything. Of course, they were blown up over several years. They weren't burned up in cities. People knew that they would start fires, so they blew them up in the desert or on islands in the Pacific or on islands off of Russia, so they wouldn't start these fires. The people knew they would start fires because Hiroshima burned to the ground. Nagasaki burned to the ground. So we know they will start fires. But you can argue about how much fuel is there in a modern city, how high does the smoke go, does it really go into the stratosphere? And so the uncertainties in this are on the front end. They're how much fuel is there in cities? It turns out that the average American has got something like 18 tons of fuel per person around them. So it's in your house, it's in the school your kid go to, it's in your grocery store, it's in this building, a lot of it is plastic. This is an actually important point, it has nothing to do with this. It used to be 10 years ago, if your fire alarm went off, you had like 10 minutes to get out of your house. Now the people who do this at NIST say you have 2 minutes to get out of your house before it flashes over and kills you. So basically, a lot of gases there, they blow up, flash over. And the reason for that is all this plastic. This plastic is incredibly flammable. So if your fire alarm goes off, you get up and leave. Mine always goes off in the middle of the night. I think spiders crawl in the middle of the night, wake me up. You know, by the time I figured out what's happening, you know, it's too late probably. But you should take fire alarms very seriously. So a lot of this is about plastic, it's about oil. It's about the wood in buildings. You have 18 tons. Americans are about twice as much junk as Europeans have and Russians have. So fuel is an issue. How much it would burn is an issue. how much of the plastic would burn, how much black carbon is in the smoke is an issue, and how high it gets. Those are all a whole chain of issues. Then there's the climate models. I don't think they're much of an issue. On the other end are agricultural models. I think the agricultural models, we need more work there, especially in ultraviolet light, and we need more people to look at that problem. So the people I work with, there's about five of us, something like that, have been working on this problem since the 1980s. Carl Sagan was my thesis advisor, so he worked on this back in the early 1980s. And there was a lot of attention paid to it back then, from you can see from the quotes I gave you. And soon after that, NATO said, no one in NATO will ever study this problem. The Department of Defense said, no one in DOD will ever be funded to study this problem. They had a National Academy panel that I was on in the early 1980s, which was one of a whole string of them had been conducted to study environmental effects of nuclear wars for decades. That one in the early 1980s was the last one for 40 years. I've spent 40 years trying to get the U.S. National Academy of Sciences to study this problem again. And we finally succeeded in that last year, and they just released a report about 2 months ago. How many people heard of the National Academy report on nuclear wars? One person. How many of you know that the United Nations voted to outlaw nuclear weapons? It is illegal to have nuclear. Wow, you're a really well-informed group. Almost no one in the United States knows that because nobody reported it in the United States except the New York Times had it in that paper once. Nuclear weapons are illegal worldwide, according to the United Nations. And you know how much attention we pay to the United Nations. So anyway, there's a lot of uncertainties in the front, uncertainties in the back. What did the National Academy study say? We should put a bunch of money in this and study it carefully, because it's important to know what's going to happen and make sure politicians know that. So they advocated that NSF, NOAA, NASA, Department of Energy, and the Department of Defense fund studies at the present time to study this. What's the chance of that? The Trump administration is defunding NSF, is defunding NOAA, is defunding NASA, and is trying to defund the universities. So I'm not optimistic that there's going to be this study, which I've been trying to have happen for 40 years. Right now, the funding we have to work on this, which we just got in the last decade from some grants, comes from something called the Future of Life Institute. It's a foundation, so it's not governmental funding. A United Nations study just started up in the last few weeks. So the United Nations is now going to study this with a panel of about 20 people on it. So it's propagating upward in the political arenas now to worry about this problem. The Department of Defense does not want to hear about this. NATO does not want to hear this message. And we're trying to force them to hear the message. And so politicians are not irrational. You know, Donald Trump does not want to die. I think information transfer is the best thing we can do. It's not going to help us to go demonstrate in the streets. People will just ignore that. But I think if we can educate the people who can do something, that some of them might take it seriously.
You were just listening to Brian Toon on dinosaurs, extinctions, and nuclear war. He spoke in Boulder, Colorado in late August. Brian Toon is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences and the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado at Boulder. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Gabor Mate, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Brian Toon on dinosaurs, extinctions, and nuclear war, and for the classic Howard Zinn book, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Tom Lehrer singing, We Will All Go Together When We Go.
We will all go together when we go, all suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go. We will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry. We will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake. With complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. We will all char together when we char, and let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a te deum when you see that ICBM, and the party will be come as you are. We will all burn together.
We are diverse, independent, and yours. CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For many Catholics, the importance of fighting climate change was articulated a decade ago in the late Pope Francis's groundbreaking letter, Laudato Si. To mark the letter's 10th anniversary, a group of Catholics from across the country made a pilgrimage to Washington, D.C. In Laudato Si, Francis emphasized that environmental destruction and poverty are part of the same crisis.
Communities who are poor and marginalized are often the ones who bear the brunt of environmental degradation and those negative consequences. And it's not two distinct calls to care for these poor people and the earth, but it's rather all one call to live in love and to follow Jesus' message of love.
This past summer, Annalise Dorchenez interned with the nonprofit Catholic Climate Covenant. In June, she and other advocates brought copies of Laudato Si to every Catholic member of Congress and talked with the officials or their staff.
We told them about why Pope Francis's message is important to us and why we think it's vital that policymakers hear and respond to the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor when they're making these big decisions that affect the whole country.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Greetings, netizens. Join us every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific for Bitcoover FM, featuring the best in chiptune, video game soundtracks, synthesized music, history of electronic instruments, and more, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We'll see you in the virtual plaza, and remember to synthesize with nostalgia.
The art of the mixtape is not lost. Tune in to the Vancouver Mixtape for your own personal mix of Vancouver's best independent music, interviews, and more. Join me, Jesse, and my co-host Jamie on our trek through Vancouver's underground, Sunday nights at 8 o'clock on CJSF.
listening to